Thank you very much. Questions, comments? Down the back there. If anyone else wants to, if you put your hand up, we can get a microphone to you. There you are, over here too.
Thank you for that. Jesley Hegney from the University of Queensland. Excuse me, thank you for that. I found that really interesting, being a strong qualitative researcher myself. Are you actually, in your study, the participants in your study, have some of the patients not got carers? Because that's a big issue that we're facing, I believe. How are we going to continue to help those people when there are no carers?
Yes, there are some, and perhaps I should say not as many as there should be, because they're very hard to get hold of them, and these people, in a sense, stand outside the whole system. So we've chosen to include them, but and I guess one of the strong senses that we derive, even from the interviews that we've conducted to date, is just how incredibly disadvantaged those individuals are. It'd be premature, and I don't know, for me to say what the answer is. I mean, do you have thoughts? What are you doing in Adelaide? What do you do about them? I don't mean that flippantly. I mean it quite seriously.
No, sorry, I'm actually in Brisbane.
Oh, Brisbane.
Yeah, right. University of Queensland. Sorry, in Blue Care. And I guess I'm also on the Committee of Management of Carers Queensland.
Mm.
And I think the carers associations are looking to this. But certainly the care providers such as Blue Care, the not-profit, increasingly see it as an issue that needs to be addressed. And I think they're looking for some good answers. There hasn't been a lot of good research, I don't think, into it.
It's a very interesting thought that it may well be that the people who are best positioned and most understanding to help resolve the problems for those without carers are carers. So it could be good. But it's a bit like the home visit thing. I mean, I don't know what your experience is, but sometimes when you meet these people, you can think, well, I know why this character hasn't got a carer. So, you know. The guy with the balsa boats that I told you about was interesting, because when he was divorced and when he became seriously ill, his wife came back to sort of provide some care, and I said to her, how come you're back? She said, the kids got onto me. So she's not what you'd describe as a thoroughly willing carer, but she was doing a pretty great job anyway.
So I'll just make one final comment if I can, and that is that I think the community nurses, so we have people who become professional carers, and certainly the nurse of the year in Queensland was a Blue Care domiciliary nurse who cared for an ex-bikie in his shed. And she was the one who was providing the carer as a professional person, because
yeah,
Nobody else was.
Well, I think that's true, isn't it? That that professionals will, in some circumstances, fill that void. I think the biggest difficulty I have is with the absence of, in an individual in an acute situation, who can clearly articulate the nuances of that person's intentions and story, who's fully capable of saying they have said they do not wish to be resuscitated. That's a very difficult role to fulfil if you don't actually know the person day by day, almost. So there's no simple answer to these things, I don't think, but if professionals and other community groups can fill some of the void, that's obviously better than nothing.
Stephen Fiona Tito-Wheatland. I've had an alternate, opposite experience, I guess, with nursing a girlfriend of mine who died last year, who was about my age. And that was that the system didn't want to have a discussion about anything other than an end-of-life choice.
No, no.
So that everyone would have been happy if she'd have said, look, really, just keep putting to sleep and everything's cool. But what she wanted to get was information about, if I do this option, will I be able to be talking to my kids till I die? If, do you know, it was more complicated than simply saying, give me an easy death. And I struggle with that a lot, because it seems to me that we're talking about quite sensitive conversations, and I don't know that we've got the training yet, perhaps, for clinicians in terms of having that discussion. This was actually at a hospice where you'd have thought they might have actually, you know, handled that stuff.
Well, I mean, it sounds very unfortunate, and what can I say? It, I think you get some professional groups. The problem with professionalising all of this is, of course, it becomes your territory. And we've always, I think all of us who are health professionals have got to watch that we don't impose our own territorial demands on those things. The other thing is it's relatively, well, not entirely new, but we're facing some new challenges as a society with chronic illness. We've got, it's a bit like having a military designed to fight conventional theatre war being faced with terrorism. You know, we're used to doing things on an acute basis, and then bingo, we've got all these people who need low-level care over decades. It's, and we don't have the ships facing the right way or even the right ships. So, but I think in all of that, preserving the humane awareness is an incredibly important thing, and not being beguiled by too much chatter about managerial options and evidence-based guidelines.
Russell McGowan from Healthcare Consumers. I applaud the objectives of your SCIPS project, and I accept the improvements that you've isolated in the pathway. However, I think some of your fundamental assumptions are flawed. The particular one I'd like you to address is whether or not you've dismissed self-management or self-care, I think was the term you used, as not being something that patients need to necessarily take on board. But I think that's based on the assumption that you are seeking them to be self-managing an illness as opposed to self-managing their life or their health. Hmm. And I wonder if you could respond to that.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to pick me up on. I guess what I was responding negatively to is what I take to be a kind of triumphalist movement, which I'm deeply suspicious of, which seems to suggest, especially based on American evidence, that you can save a lot of money by getting people to manage themselves. And you're right, that is largely disease management. All the business about equipping people with life skills to manage is something that I have a strong attachment to. I tend to call it health literacy, simply because it's about equipping people to make informed decisions about health and participate in the kind of health debate that we heard before lunch about. I mean, why not? Why shouldn't there be education in how to be a participant consumer of healthcare? So, yeah, I mean, if I didn't mean to convey the sense that I don't think it has a place. It obviously does.
Flinders University at the moment in an attempt to try and get the notion of self-management support inculcated into the training of all clinicians.
Yeah.
Of course, that's all well and good. Once they graduate, they go out into practice and they'll have all of that beaten out of them by the people who don't practice self-management support.
Yeah.
So I think there's a danger in going down with more of the same, having more doctors and more clinicians providing these solutions, when in fact you need a much broader solution that involves carers, that involves community supports, that are not specifically health supports, but which will help consumers manage their health rather than just focusing on the illness.
Well, I guess everybody will hear what they want to hear in what I've said, but I didn't say any of that, actually. So I fully support the idea that this is something that has to be done. I thought I conveyed a fairly clear sense about the critical role of the care, of having coordinated team care, and I've tried to correct the impression that I don't believe in self-care. I do, but I don't see that that there really is incompatible with the things I said, but I guess we'll have to differ.
Stephen Rosemary, Young Frontier Services. I want to thank you for humanising the issues for us. I think we can get so bound up in the policy and the system that we forget that really what matters is the people.
Mm.
And every one of us would say we know the system backwards and we know our way in and out and around it. And when it happens to us, as you demonstrated in what happened to you, we find that it is actually overwhelming.
Oh.
And if we can't cope, nobody else can.
Yeah.
So your bringing that element of humanity has been a real gift to us today. Thank you for it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, that was a very good point. The culture of humanity, I think, is what we need to be getting back to. Karen, where's Karen? Oh,